You weren't the only one to complain. That's why they actually try to pretty well to kind of deal with that. Of course, unfortunately, the guy who used to do the technical articles became a silent key, and they replaced him with this Dave guy who does a YouTube, which I never particularly cared for personally, but, you know, what the hell. But, yeah, I try to subscribe to as many magazines as still around that have any interest for me because, you know, I want to see them around for a few more years. You know, most people have moved on and they read the stuff on the Internet and, you know, it takes up too much space in their home probably or it's too expensive, I don't know. And the ad space has dwindled. Most advertisers are putting the money into the Internet as well. So I think magazines are going to eventually fade away. So I'm trying to give them extended, life support. So I urge everyone out there who has a soft spot for certain magazines, rather than borrow them from a friend, you know, subscribe to them so that they'll be around for more than a couple of years.
Well, I have to agree with you. There's a whole bunch of car and motorcycle magazines that I continue to get, some of which have become quite technical and are, you know, for the specific marks that they're representing, and some of which have become nothing more than fluff. And the fluff ones, I think, are going to disappear on their own, but the technical ones still seem to manage to get some advertising, especially since the products that they purport are quite niche. But it does seem to be, a closing or a dying art. Although National Geographic is such beautiful photography that it's just worth that for the pictures.
Yeah, it's good to hear. Unfortunately, every year another one drops off. I had an audio magazine that just kind of stopped publishing last year. I had Popular Science, and it's a very, very common way to kill a magazine. You go from a monthly magazine to a bi-monthly magazine to a quarterly magazine to no magazine. And I've seen it happen to more than a few of them. Of course, you know, some like CQ Magazine, the publisher got sick and passed away, and that's the end of that one. So, you know, they're all kind of fading away, and no one in their right mind is starting a new magazine as far as I'm aware. But, you know, I kind of cherish the ones that still are around, and I support them as best I can. There's another one called Nuts and Bolts that's kind of on life support. You know, they're in a situation very much like CQ Magazine, where they've been skipping issues. So, you know, I'll get an issue that's dated a year and a half ago because, you know, they're incrementally dating these magazine issues, even though they missed a whole bunch of them. So that doesn't really sound like it's long for this world. But, again, if you're so inclined and you're interested in electronics, take a look at Nuts and Bolts.
Oh, I haven't seen that in 10 or 15 years. I used to pick it up at a local surplus electronics store down in Florida that was very close to where I was living. I suppose I should have probably looked for a subscription. It never occurred to me.
I still subscribe
yeah.
to that, but I only get it online. I don't get a paper copy. How do you get a paper copy, Roy? I'll get it if I can.
What, Nuts and Bolts?
Yeah.
I don't know. I paid for a paper copy, and it's not very consistent. Like I said, they're backdating their issues, but I get them.
Wow. Well, man, I subscribed to that for years and years and years, and got all the issues. They saved the issues. I've thrown them out now from way back when. But I gotta contact them, see if I can get it in paper again. However, often they come. Thank you, AFCP.
You're welcome. I'm glad to remind you of Nuts and Bolts. It's a nice magazine. I got it on a discount at the very beginning, and then I've just been paying at the usual rate. And it has some interesting articles. it's kind of a little bit of this, a little bit of that. It's sort of more maker electronics than... Once again, this is still AC2GS. We got a couple of minutes to go. If anyone has any fast questions or comments or what have you, hit that push to talk.
KB2MAR.
Yes, what can I do you for?
My name here is Gabe, and I want to add to the person who wanted to get a vertical antenna or any type of antenna for HF frequencies. I want to try a vertical antenna with an elevated ground plane. Basically, you would have like a dozen elements, your horizontal elements, raised above the air on a tripod. And then you would have the vertical element, of course, in the center. I think like a dozen elements would do the trick. That's for low angle of radiation. Of course, if you want to do NVIS, you're going to just use four horizontal elements for the vertical in the center, of course. I don't remember the website, I'm sorry, the person who did this. To go online and research it, this is KB2MAR back to net control.
Yeah, there's a guy promoting a lot of antennas, which one or two of them is basically above ground, where you can kind of decrease the number of radials. You know, if you put it smack on the ground, you got a lot of ground coupling, and, you know, most people who've researched it, you usually come up with the magic number, 36 radials, but as you lift it off of the ground, it couples less with that ground, and you can get away with far less. You know, if you have it elevated a significant degree, you know, three or four radials are enough for an omnidirectional radiation pattern. I think there's, I think it's called Commander or something, I forget exactly the name for this. He's promoting it a lot for parks on the air activations, you know, for mobile, for portable operations.
Yes. I can hear him in this control point, but, you know, I saw the antenna in operation. It works really, really well. And, of course, the mag loops are also great, too. We'll look through that, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, they serve different purposes. I mean, the beauty of magnetic loops is there's no problem. You don't have to deal with radials. You don't have to deal with elevation. It usually operates reasonably well, just 6 feet above the ground. But it's a very inefficient antenna. And so as long as you don't mind the inefficiencies, especially since there's no way to measure them, it just produces a performance hit. But, I mean, otherwise, it's a very, very high Q, so you either need to retune it incessantly, either in person or via a servo. But, I mean, given those limitations, it's a very nice design, and especially in the urban environment where you can't always climb up to the top of roofs and such, it's a nice option.
That's for sure. Might want to consider getting, I don't know if you get a mag loop for 160, but that's probably going to be like almost impossible. I don't know if you can do it for 160, especially for transmitting. I don't know about that. For receiving is one thing, but transmitting is another.
Yeah, that's you really need to come up with an interesting design. And I don't think I've seen a 160 that's been particularly well received. I've seen some 80s where instead of making the loop larger, they make the loop kind of two loops in a row. You know, you kind of pushing the laws of physics at 80 meters. So at 160, you know, your losses will be ridiculous. You know, it's almost as bad as a hamstick that's set to 160 that's sitting on a fender on someone's car. You know, if you're okay with efficiency of 0.1%, then God bless you.
This is KB2MAR. Yeah, I've been researching a lot of antennas to put up in the back of the house over here. And also considered a horizontal, a full-wave horizontal loop. My property is pretty big here, so I can put up a full wave one. So I think they only have to be like 30 feet above ground, something like that, for it to work properly. And a dipole would work good too. The problem is I don't have the supports high enough for a certain band, you know what I mean? So for a loop antenna, you could do one for 80 meters, like 30 feet above ground.
Yeah, you just need a good amount of space that certainly in the city you don't have. You know, the lots are 20 feet usually by 100 feet, and part of that is the sidewalk that you can't really use, so it's the backyard and the house that's 20 by 50. So you kind of run out of space. But yeah, full wave loops are very nice antennas if you have the space for it.
Great about them is that you don't have to have, like I said before, it could be a certain height above ground and that's it. That's where a 160 loop, you have to have like a shortened loop for 160 though. A 160 full wave is humongous. Then again, like a, figure it out, magazine, the old ones. Or even the ARRL antenna book will help you out quite a bit. All right, Roy, I'm going to step out here. Thanks for the input. This is KBJMAR, back to that. Now over to you there, Roy.
You're welcome. Yeah, the ARRL handbook, antenna handbook, is an excellent publication. I own a couple of different antenna handbooks, one from the Radio Society of Great Britain and a German-translated antenna handbook. They're very big. They're reasonably priced for the amount of information that they have. They do not give you nosebleeds or headaches by discussing matrix math. It's a very practical approach to an incredible number of different antenna designs. So, you know, if you want to spend a couple of bucks on a good book, you know, get the ARRL antenna handbook. The only problem is that it has so much information on so many different antennas that sometimes people don't have the patience to kind of read through it. I mean, I was one of those kids who read from the top, beginning to end of, you know, encyclopedias. So I enjoyed the kind of reading through it. But, you know, some people want their questions answered quickly. And if that's the case, there's a very good index in the back, and you could jump right to the design that you're interested in. Anyway, it's always fun to discuss antennas. We do that a great deal here on the Technical Net, and I appreciate people bring questions and comments and answers. And, you know, today we learned a little bit more about free space impedance, which is great. That's one of the good things about this Technical Net. I learn, you learn. Anyway, thanks to everyone who participated. It's 10:17 and change, so it's certainly a good time to move it on. SpaceNet report.
To GSWS2N. Good topics tonight, anyway. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And I was going to report about the new rocket that was going to be launched today, called the New Glenn. From Florida, New Glenn is built by Blue Origin, and so far it's had one successful launch back in January. That was, you know, and this was going to be the second one. It's a heavy lift vehicle, which puts it in direct competition with Elon Musk and SpaceX. So the New Glenn, it's been developed over many years, of course, by Jeff Bezos, who owns that company. The rocket, it's a two-stage rocket. It's over 300 feet tall. And it was supposed to launch around a quarter to three today, but unfortunately, a couple of clouds came by and weather restrictions delayed it for about an hour or so, and they had a window of about an hour and a half, and toward the end they scrubbed the mission. Next test will actually be tomorrow. But I was looking forward for this thing to take off. First one that went up in January, they would have been happy if it made it to orbit, and which it did. It's a two-stage rocket. First stage successfully launched back then with seven BE-4 engines. These are liquid methane, liquid oxygen. Actually, it's liquid LNG, slightly different than pure methane, but close enough. Very clean gas when it's burnt, which is good for reusability. It doesn't foul up a lot of the mechanisms that are involved in rocketry. So there's less maintenance in putting it back into operation. These are going to be reusable vehicles. So you have the New Glenn, which on this flight, the first flight, they were happy to make it to orbit, and they were going to try to land it on a drone ship a couple hundred miles off the coast of Florida. That part, they did not succeed in January of doing that. They came close, but they had some sloshing and different problems with the fuel tanks to be able to do that. But they need to reignite the engines, and that didn't work out. First couple engines ignited, but then they had a problem. So they believe that's all fixed and repaired now, and on this brand new first stage, they believe that this time they got a good chance at landing that first stage on the drone that's 400 miles away, after liftoff. I'd like to see that happen. What'll happen is, it'll come down after about 2 minutes of flight, a little over 2 minutes of flight. The first stage uses up all its fuel. The second stage then ignites and brings the payload to orbit. In this case, the first stage will come back down, using its seven engines to put it into put the first stage into orbit. Those seven stages shut down a couple of minutes later. The three engines reignite to slow it down coming through the atmosphere. And when it gets close to the drone ship, one more engine will, the center engine will be the only engine lit, and hopefully it will come down slowly onto the drone ship. This is similar to what SpaceX has done really literally hundreds of times. This will be the first time for New Glenn. So let me just talk about the payload for a second. After the second stage and first stage separate, first stage continues on with two engines. They're called BE-3 engines. BE-3 engines are liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. So first stage is, liquid natural gas as a fuel. Second stage is hydrogen. And they're well-proven engines because they are the same engines, BE-3, that they've been flying for years, I think since 2010, when they first launched the New Shepard. New Shepard is a suborbital rocket that they've been launching with and without people since 2010. And up until now, I think they've put up a total of around 60-some-odd people into suborbital space with the New Glenn. And they use the BE-3 engine. BE-3 engine, very successful. It They have one engine on the suborbital flights. And then, again, that comes back down and lands vertically, and that is reused. So since they had very success with that, they used the same BE-3 engines for the second stage of this big monster, New Glenn. And they used two of those engines on the second stage instead of one. Each one of those puts out around 125,000 pounds of thrust. So you have two of them. You compare that to the thrust of the first stage, which has those liquid natural gas engines. They have around 550,000 pounds of thrust each. Anyway, you get very close to 4 million pounds of thrust for the first stage. And the second stage, you're really running around 250,000 pounds of thrust. So it's the largest second stage rocket that's pretty much ever been launched by anybody. And it worked on the first flight back in January, and hopefully it'll work on this flight as well. Like I said, it was canceled, and tomorrow they're going to try again. There was no mechanical problems. It was just a weather-related issue. They'll give it a shot tomorrow around 2, I think it's around the same time, 2:40 or 2, yeah, I think it's 2:40 in the afternoon, Eastern time. They, launch out of Florida, of course. They've rebuilt the complete launch complex 36 at Cape Canaveral. And, they've completely renovated that. So hopefully this thing will be successful because the payload for this rocket is it's called the Escape. It's called the Escapade spacecraft. There's two of them that will be put up, at the same time tomorrow. Escapade, again, it's an acronym. It's called the Escape and Plasma Acceleration and Dynamics Explorer. And the goal is to eventually have these two spacecraft go into orbit around Mars. So here's this, new rocket. First time it was flown, successfully got to orbit. Second time it's flying, it's going to put two spacecraft in orbit around Mars. So I think that's really pretty good. You compare that to the problems that SpaceX is having with the Starship rocket that has launched now 6 different times, and they still haven't put one of those things into orbit yet. And number 12 is not planned on going into orbit as well, and that will be launched early next year. So we'll see. This could be the case of, the rabbit and the frog. Which one's going to really take a note with NASA? Which one is going to be the one that they're probably going to choose for actually putting somebody on the moon? Which big rocket, the Starship, still under development, or this one that's already successfully flown once and hopefully tomorrow, maybe a second time? And again, that's supposed to be reusable 400 miles out at sea. The first stage will come back down and hopefully land on, they named the ship Jacqueline, the big barge out that they built. It's bigger than a football field. So if you go out on a football field and look how big that is, that's how big this freaking barge is. So we'll see. Hopefully that will go the way I hope it will go. Because after that, you're going to eventually have reusability with that this exact same rocket. I mean, a couple of months from now, they'll relaunch that first stage as well. Now, for the Escapade satellites, they're going to be put like into a temporary location once they're into space. They're going to send them to the L2 location. L2 is the Lagrange point 2. It's 5 Lagrange points. You know, what they are is an area where you could put a spacecraft and use minimal amount of fuel to keep it there for months and years at a time. They're going to put them at L2, Lagrange point 2, which is a million miles away from the Earth, about four times the distance of the Moon. It'll hang out. It'll probably visit the James Webb Space Telescope that's located out there. And it will stay there for actually, I think, 8 or 10 months. And the reason for that is Mars and Earth are not in alignment right now. They need to be a little closer to one another. So they're going to hang out there for all these months, and at some point, the two spacecraft, they have their own engines, they'll ignite and push themselves in the direction of Mars to eventually orbit that planet. So, let me just, I've been going on about New Glenn, but if anybody has any comments about it, let me know. This is WS2N. Name here is Paul. Okay, nothing heard. But we'll see how it goes tomorrow. I'll report on this next week. You know, hopefully it goes well. The Escapade missions are NASA-paid missions. And Escapade spacecraft are built by another rocket company that's built by Rocket Lab. Who are very successful at launching their small rockets. Rocket Lab launches the Electron rocket from two locations. It launched from New Zealand. They have two launch pads there, and they have one launch pad in the United States over in Wallops Island, Virginia. So they also build satellites and spacecraft. In this case, they built the Escapade for, I think the total cost was around $20 million for this. I mean, including the launch, very inexpensive deal for two spacecraft going to Mars. So I was very happy to see that. The idea is to drive the cost of things down. And in this case, NASA did. You know, normally a Mars mission is, you know, $500 million or a couple of billion dollars. This thing they're going to be able to do for, you know, $30 million. Any comments? Okay, nothing heard. About a week or so ago, China launched a crew to the Tiangong Space Station. Tiangong Space Station is, of course, owned and operated by China. And they have the capability of keeping three people on board roughly 6 months per year. And every 6 months or so, they need to change out the crew, which is what they did. They launched the Shenzhou, they call it the Shenzhou 21 spacecraft up to the Tiangong Space Station to meet the crew from the Shenzhou 20 that is still there. So they have a couple of docking ports there. So right now you have two spacecraft attached to the Chinese space station with a total of six people. No problem. They hung out for a week or so. And the plan was to come to have the original ones that went up come back on their spacecraft and leave the other three up there. Standard operating procedure. As they were getting ready to depart, they noticed that there was a problem with the returning spacecraft. Turns out there's apparently they got hit by some kind of debris. They imagine it's a very small piece of something or other, but when things travel at, 17,000 miles per hour, it could actually cause quite a bit of damage. So right now they're evaluating that damage, and they're now stuck with six people on board that spacecraft. And with only two docking ports, it could be a problem. They have another one that they could probably dock to that they usually use for cargo, and that's probably what they're going to do. It looks like they do have an extra spacecraft on Earth and another rocket that they could launch as a rescue kind of mission. And but right now they're evaluating the situation of the existing spacecraft, see if it checking out the damage, see what it's like, to see if it's safe to bring a crew back on that. But if not, the goal is to eventually send another spacecraft up there and have that crew eventually return, and then have the spacecraft damaged also return. So it sounds like a similar story to what happened with the Starliner mission that Boeing built, when we had two astronauts stuck on the International Space Station for about 10 months, I guess it was. And eventually they returned safely on a different spacecraft. They came back on a SpaceX Falcon Dragon. And that's, you never know. But I'll be following that to see how it works out. There's a lot of space junk up there, millions of teeny tiny pieces. Sometimes it's as big as a flake of paint. I've told that story many times, where space shuttle was up in orbit one day they looked at the 4-inch thick glass, and it was like a little thing in there, bullseye type of thing in the glass. And what they figured out what that was caused from was a speck of paint traveling in the opposite direction of the space shuttle. They eventually figured out that it was a speck of paint from an Israeli spacecraft that was launched from Israel at one time. So they had this one spacecraft going 17,000 miles an hour, in the easterly direction. That's the space shuttle. And then you had another spacecraft that was launched from Israel, and they launched in the opposite direction of the way the Earth spins, because they don't want to send a spacecraft over Arab countries. They don't want, last thing they want is one of their vehicles accidentally coming down in the wrong country. So what they do is they launch over the Mediterranean. They go west. So because they did that, there was one little speck of paint, and they eventually figured this out because there was some of it left in the space shuttle. When the space shuttle returned, they were able to take that paint analyzed it, and they figured out that that is the exact same paint that is used on a Israeli payload. So here these two things, you know, coming at each other at what 34,000 miles per hour. That's what it hit at, and one little speck of paint dinged up a glass on a 4-inch thick glass on the space shuttle. And we have thousands and thousands of junk flying around up there where the space station has been hit by multiple hits over the years. So is this new space station by China, and it's inevitable. But they try to keep their distance. Anything over, I think it's anything over 4 inches or 10 centimeters can be tracked by radar. And it's all documented, and that's what we do. We know where everything is. If something is coming close to the space station at a certain time, they know to move the space station, or if it's a satellite, they can actually move that satellite one way or another to keep it out of the way of the International Space Station. So that's what goes on. Any comments? This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report. Nothing heard. It's been a long time since we had any conversations about contacts with the International Space Station, but that's still going on. Ares is still making contacts. There's always at least a few people on board the space station that are ham radio operators, and they're always either contacting Earth using the Columbus module, or on the Russian side, they use the Zvezda module. They have 2-meter radio in there, and they contact different countries, with visiting astronauts or cosmonauts from Russia, and so it's always going on. Hopefully, that will continue beyond the space station. I mean, the space station itself is going to eventually deorbit 2030, 2031, something like that. By that time, we hope we'll have some American commercial space stations in operation where they could continue that. Eventually, have I guess they will. We'll have to change the name, the Ares, amateur radio on the International Space Station. I have to give it a new, a new name. Before the space station, they had the SARAX mission. The SARAX was the shuttle amateur radio experiment. Before the space station existed, that's what they used. People used to contact the space station. And hopefully in the future, if we ever get to the moon, there might be two locations you might be able to get a QSL card from. One would be, of course, the moon. Eventually, they plan on setting up a base on the south portion of the moon, the polar south pole. So that would be one possibility. And then another possibility would be the Gateway space station itself, which this administration is so mixed up. I mean, I've heard stories where they canceled it. They might cancel it. Anyway, I don't believe it will ever be canceled. There's even hardware being built for the Gateway Space Station. Gateway Space Station will be orbiting the moon, and I could picture someday setting up an amateur radio station inside the Gateway Space Station. Eventually, you'll have a crew, like two or three, orbiting the moon for, they predict like 3 or 4 months at a time, no more than that. Probably in the beginning, probably maybe just a month or so. But they'll need something to do, you know. How much science can you do? You know, now you have time off. They'd be able to, you know, contact Earth. I've got to get my QSL card from either the moon or Gateway. Any comments? Okay. One last thing I wanted to talk about was the X-59. X-59's been under development for quite a few years by NASA. NASA is the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. So the aeronautics is plane flight. And one of the important missions that they've been putting together is the X-59. The goal is to have a jet plane that they could fly faster than the speed of sound. In this case, it'll be going at 1.4 Mach, which is probably, you know, close to 1,000 miles an hour. And they wanted to be able to fly this thing over land. You know, when the Concorde was out there, Concorde would fly naturally to Europe. And over water, it would go 1,300 miles an hour, breaking the sound barrier. So nobody worried about the sound barrier, the blast from breaking the sound barrier. When they flew over land, you know, I used to see them land in Kennedy. I'd be driving at work, and I'd see this thing overhead. And, of course, they weren't going faster than the speed of sound, but over the water they did. Now, the X-59 is an experimental plane. It's got this real long nose to it. I mean, you know, whatever the whole length is, let's call it 100 feet. The top, you know, half of it is like all nose, pointy long nose. It's really cool looking. And it only takes one pilot, and he's got an ejection seat in case something goes wrong. And they've, last week, or I think about 10 days ago, they flew it over to Mojave Desert. And they flew it for about 3 hours. They didn't break the sound barrier. They're just testing it this year, early test for the X-59. But somewhere along the line, they plan on flying this thing over land. And when they do, they want to eventually get reports when they go over towns and cities, see what people heard or what they didn't hear. And they said, well, maybe at the motion, there might be a little thump noise, but really not noticeable. If this is a successful mission by X-59, you know, in the years to come, other, you know, private companies, you know, will be able to take the design and scale it up and eventually possibly create a passenger airplanes that will be able to fly faster than the speed of sound without creating the big blast that you hear on Earth, which could break windows, rattle windows, wake up all the dogs. You know, you don't need that. But you know, you could imagine making it from, you know, California to New York in half the amount of time, whatever it is now. You know, well, we'll see. I know there's a company called Boom, B-O-O-M, terrible name for a plane, that's developing jets that will be able to break the sound barrier, but not over land. They'll be going over water. Well, we'll see. Be interesting to see what happens. Look up in the sky 10 years from now to see jet planes flying, faster than the speed of sound. Who knows? Technology is a wonderful thing. Any comments? WS2N. All quiet. Roy, I don't have any other topics, and we didn't have any questions, so that would have slowed me down, but what are you going to do? So I'm going to pass it back to you, Roy. Anybody listening, tomorrow is the Limark Club InfoNet, and that's always followed by Swap and Shop, and that's always followed by Radio Newsline. So, and somebody asked about the ham fair. They will give an extensive report about the ham fair during the Club InfoNet tomorrow. So that would be a good thing to listen to. Roy, over to you. AC2GS, WS2N for the Space Net Report for the TechNet. Back to you.
Okay, very good, Paul. Thank you for the Space Net Report. Thank you for all that you do here on the Technical Net. And all that you do for the club, we all appreciate it. So thanks to everyone who participated tonight as well. Hope you had fun. Hope you learned a few things. And hope you were amused. And I hope you'll join us next Sunday when we do this all over again. As per usual, let me leave you with a couple of clever comments from clever men. One, our own Dick K2RIW. We always end his Technical Nets with the advice to be kind to each other. That's always good advice. And good old Epictetus, it's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So try and keep your mind open to new ideas, but not so wide open that your brain falls out. So, everyone, stay safe, be well, have a great week, enjoy yourself, and please come back if you can next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. This is AC2GS, and I will be clear after I say, Slava Ukraini.
Complete. W2VL repeater.